Critical Readings, a podcast of literary discussion and analysis, starring Sean Philip Cooper, Drew Keen, and Jack Tyler. Hello and welcome to Critical Readings, episode 104 for the 22nd of November, 2021. I'm Dr. Cooper, and with me today I have two panelists. They are Drew Keen.
Salutations.
And Jack Tyler.
Thanks for having me.
Greetings, gentlemen. I'm not feeling tip-top today, so unfortunately, I'll need to leave the bulk of the speaking to you, or perhaps fortunately, as it happens. Maybe our readers are tired of listening to me, so we're going to give them a reprieve today, and I hope to be better soon. I've been battling this ear infection, upper respiratory infection thing for about 4 to 5 weeks. And I thank my children for bringing it home and giving it to me in their generosity. But hopefully I'll be better soon. And in the meantime, we have a special treat this week. It's a poet that I don't know very well, and so all the more reason for me to shut up. And that is the poet Richard Wilbur. And Richard Wilbur is 20th century poet who was selected for us by Drew Keen. So I'm going to let Drew give us a little introduction to his biography, if you would.
Sure. I first encountered Richard Wilbur in a world literature class in undergraduate school, and it was his translation of Racine's play Phaedra that caught my attention. But aside from being one of the foremost translators of French neoclassical theater into English, Wilbur was also a poet, born in 1921 in New York City, and two-time Pulitzer Prize winner, first in 1957 and then again in 1988, and a longtime poet laureate of the United States and a professor of English as well, a graduate of Amherst College and of Harvard, and a soldier in the Second World War. His original poetry has won remarkable accolades. I mean, the list of prizes is a mile long. But then also his verse translation is widely considered some of the best verse translation the world has ever known, on the level of Alexander Pope. And being able to produce translations that approximate the experience of the poetry in the other language, in the original language, but also poetry that stands on its own in the target language of the translation. So it's rare to get both of those things, something that faithfully represents the original and also works as a first-rate poem in the target language. So a remarkable achievement. And he also did the libretto for a Broadway musical by Leonard Bernstein called Candide, which is how Dr. Cooper knows Richard Wilbur.
Indeed, I'm a big fan of Bernstein's Candide, much more than West Side Story, which I don't particularly care for, but Candide is brilliant and great fun, musically and in terms of its book, which Wilbur did. And the book is witty and clever and enormously funny and a good time for all. And that's why it's so popular, even now.
I should say the other aspect of Wilbur is that he's associated with the New Formalist movement in late 20th century American verse. So he's sort of the contrast to Sylvia Plath, and for a very long time was out of favor in elite literary circles, although that did eventually change and taste came around to formalism again. But when the confessionalists were in vogue, Wilbur was thought lesser of. So it's a nice contrast to Plath, who we just did recently. So his poetry is almost entirely in traditional forms and emphasizes wit and technical virtuosity over the more overt emotional aspects of verse. And I think that'll be clear in the poems that we've selected. One other thing I'll add just finally is that his verse translations of French neoclassical theater are also widely performed. And that's sort of a third remarkable feature of those translations, is that they work on the stage. They're actable, which is quite an impressive feat. To think that you could do a play in heroic couplets on the American stage in the 21st century is hard to believe, but it does happen.
We need more of it, not less. I'd like to see more heroic couplets in everyday life.
Mm-hmm. Well, I like what he said about...
Oh, go ahead, Jack, please.
What he said about traditional forms and rhymes and meter, he said that limitation makes for power, and the strength of the genie comes from his being confined in a bottle.
Oh, that's marvelous.
It's an important sentiment, and one that pushes back against the idea that, you know, absolute freedom of action is actually absolute freedom and not indeed, you know, slavery to one's appetites and drives. And one I'm pleased to say is growing in its uptake. People are coming around to the idea that that a little constraint at least is a freeing thing, right? It allows you, it frees you from the tyranny of choice. It allows you to work within a set of respectable limitations in order to, you know, perfect your art.
Right. And I think certainly the pandemic has, you know, revealed that to people as their regular schedules are disrupted and routines. We see that there's not a great liberation, you know, but actually the need for new and different structures.
Absolutely. As some of you know, I record another podcast before this one, which is about video games of all things. And one of the panelists, no modern formalist or anything of the sort this week, opined that he prefers games that have constraints in them because it gives him more direction and makes it more interesting for him than ones that are just completely open where you can do whatever you want. Those are uninteresting and they become boring and, you know, there's no real drive or need to do anything. So I think that constraints and form give us essential guides to help us pursue the good and the true and the beautiful. Without them, we find ourselves kind of just drifting aimlessly.
I think it gets to the very nature of art itself. I mean, there is no art without constraint because you wouldn't be able to distinguish it from what just occurred in nature. It's when you start to notice some patterns, something that happens with regularity that you can say, oh, no, that somebody designed this.
Yes.
And therefore there's intent behind it. And I should notice what the intent is and try to appreciate what they've designed. But if you don't have any kind of constraint, then you can't even distinguish it as art.
Just so. I feel this way about the artwork, that banana that is duct taped to a wall, right? I mean, how is one to derive intentionality, right, from what might...
It's a fine meeting of nature and artifice, you know, the banana and the duct tape.
I'm going to eject you into the scene, Jack. That's where you're going. from the podcast, Jack. Tyler.
Perhaps that could be your great work of performance art, in which your panel is cast into the sea, perhaps with a millstone around.
We'll
his
tape
neck.
Jack to a wall with some duct tape. There we go. Well,
I think that probably happened to me at some sort of youth group lock-in already. So it's been attempted. I assure
don't
you.
Want to dig up any unpleasant memories. So. We must turn to the poetry here, Richard Wilbur, and we have four poems. We're going to try to get to them all, but we have four poems selected. Mm-hmm. And the first one, which Jack has selected as a lovely name, is Love Calls Us to the Things of This World. So I'll turn it over to Jack.
Yes. Love Calls Us to the Things of This World, 1956. The eyes open to a cry of pulleys. Inspirited from sleep, the astounded soul hangs for a moment, bodiless and simple as false dawn. Outside the open window, the morning air is all awash with angels. Some are in bedsheets, some are in blouses, some are in smocks, but truly, there they are. Now they are rising together in calm swells of halcyon feeling, filling whatever they wear with deep joy of their impersonal breathing. Now they are flying in space, conveying the terrible speed of their omnipresence, moving and swaying like white water. And now, of a sudden, they swoon down in so rapt a quiet that nobody seems to be there. The soul shrinks from all that it is about to remember, from the punctual rape of every blessed day, and cries, "Oh, let there be nothing on earth but laundry, nothing but rosy hands and the rising steam, and clear dances shown in the sight of heaven." Yet, as the sun acknowledges, with a warm look on the world's hunks and colors, the soul descends once more in bitter love to accept the waking body, saying now in a changed voice as the man yawns and rises, "Bring them down from their ruddy gallows. Let there be clean linen for the backs of thieves. Let lovers go fresh and sweet to be undone. And the heaviest nuns walk in a pure floating of dark habits, keeping their difficult balance.
Thank you for that, Jack. Okay, so why this poem, and what strikes you about it?
So I think what would perhaps be helpful for our listeners first is just a brief explication of the what's being pictured here in the poem. So imagine yourself waking up in a Manhattan brownstone at the first light of day, and perhaps your bed faces towards a window, and outside, and you know, in that golden moment, all you can see is laundry on the drying lines, right? We awaken to the sound of pulleys, and we're bringing in our laundry to fold in for a brief moment. It looks like the streets and alleyways are full of angels, full of disembodied ethereal spirits. And there's there's a lightness and a beauty and a joy to that moment. But of course, it's an ephemeral moment, and we really must rise and face the day. So I think that that might be helpful, just so we know what Richard Wilbur is talking about.
Thank you for the explanation. So now I'll circle back to that question. What is so captivating for you about the idea of waking up in a brownstone and gazing out the window of the laundry on the line?
You know, it's I think for the simple and universal reason that it's not always easy to get out of bed, right? at least for me, and especially when there's no.
I've got news for you. The older you get, the harder it is.
The harder it is, yes. Especially on a lovely Saturday morning like this. I think there's that cry of let there be nothing on earth but laundry, nothing but rosy hands in the rising steam, and clear dances done in the sight of heaven. I think to get out of bed is to reckon with the difficulties and complexities of our waking life. Right? Is it not so much more pleasant to drift in and out of sleep and to dream? We must alas, get out of bed. And, as the medievals remind us, the cure for sloth is charity, right? And we think of the title of this poem, Love Calls Us to the Things of This World. So it is, you know, it is in fact charity, that compels us not to live as, sort of disembodied spirits, flitting about in our dreams, like laundry flits about in the alleyways. But you know, we must eventually rise. Richard Wilbur goes on to say, he says, yet as the sun acknowledges with a warm look, the world's hunks and colors, right? The laundry doesn't have hunks and colors. It's all sort of seamless and floating and graceful. But the world isn't like that. It's full of hunks and colors. And he goes on to say, in that next last stanza, the soul descends once more in bitter love to accept the waking body, saying now in a changed voice, as the man yawns and rises. So our soul isn't out there with the laundry. It's here in our bodies. We must bring the laundry inside. Bring them, that's the laundry, down from their ruddy gallows. Let there be clean linen for the backs of thieves. Let lovers go fresh and sweet to be undone. And let the heaviest nuns walk in a pure floating of dark habits, keeping their difficult balance. Someone makes me think of the incarnation. You know, the soul descends once more in bitter love to accept the waking body. Love compels us to the things of this world. And love moved the Son of God to become human and to walk and minister among us. Clothe the backs of thieves, as it were. I think the allusion to thieves on gallows is quite interesting there in the last stanza. It's love that calls us to act and to do. And I know that for some people that may seem like a bit of an interpretive stretch, but I will say that Richard Wilbur, I mean, he was a lifelong Episcopalian, so I don't think these things were, you know, ever too far from his mind.
I I want to come at it from a slightly different angle that I hope will be complementary to what Jack has said, all of which I think is right. This is one of Wilbur's most anthologized poems, and there's a very good reason for that, and it's the sophistication of its artistry. And so when you first encounter the poem sort of line by line, the way in which it probably unfolds for you, I think, is part of how it's designed to work. So I just wanted to look through the first few lines and sort of explain what I mean by that. The eyes open to a cry of pulleys, and spirited from sleep, the astounded soul hangs for a moment bodiless and simple as false dawn. So you don't really know what the pulleys are pulling at this point, or where they are, or where you are. It almost sounds as if the body is being lifted up by pulleys, or perhaps the soul is being lowered into the body by pulleys. And this opening up of the eyes, this experience of coming awake, is, I think, aptly described with the word cry, even though it's not the person that's doing the crying. But that sense of not wanting to wake up is conjured up with that, a cry of pulleys, spirited from sleep, which both has this sort of double meaning, this idea that the spirit is reanimated as you're waking up or returning to the body in a sense. And then that your sleep is being spirited away, taken away from you. So this possibility of multiple meanings is part of what makes this such a brilliant poem. And it's not even then that you have enough to figure out that he's describing the laundry out on the line. So you have to press forward to figure out what in the world is all this about. Outside the open window, the morning air is all awash with angels. And you still don't know what in the world does that mean. Is it just imagining that there are angels outside of the window? What does he mean that it's awash with angels? And then finally, in the next stanza, you finally start to see what in the world he's talking about. Some are in bedsheets, some are in blouses, some are in smocks, but truly, there they are. So that at that point, you have enough to sort of piece together the image. You can see the line spread from house to house, and then all of these linens hanging and blowing about in the wind. And you think, oh, as he's waking up and the grogginess of the morning, you know, he can barely see, and it looks like there are angels out there with their white wings aflutter, but it's the laundry. And of course, we don't typically do laundry this way anymore because we all have drying machines now. But still, in other parts of the world, one of the things I was shocked about when I moved to Scotland was the number of people who didn't have drying machines and still had to hang up their laundry outside, which was always a bit of a pill because sometimes it was far too cold for anything to get dry. But
yeah,
that's
it's
a whole
not like
other
it
story.
Rains in Scotland or anything like that.
Right. But it's what he's describing here is a common kind. What was once a common kind of experience.
Indeed,
that's harder for us to imagine now because we don't do it this way anymore.
When I grew up, we put everything on the line. It was just
right
the way of it.
Picking up on a really ordinary and mundane thing like the laundry hanging out on the line and spinning out of it all of these associations, the rich connections to the significance of the spirit and of the interconnectedness of things. I mean, it's just brilliantly done. And as you move through it line by line and it unfolds in that way, this experience has been perfectly staged for the reader.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think only
noticed,
a poet laureate.
A formal issue is the beginning of this poem is really heavy on alliteration, and that fades about halfway through the poem. So if we look at this opening stanza, we have the eyes open to a cry of pulleys, and spirited from sleep, the astounded soul hangs for a moment bodiless and simple. Lots of S's and sibilant sounds as the pulleys perhaps whistle and cry, right?
Yeah.
And then outside the open window, the morning air is all awash with angels. It's reiterated alliterative sounds, and it continues in the next line. Some are in bedsheets, some are in blouses, some are in smocks, but truly, there they are. And there's this intense reiteration of this, and it continues until about the third stanza, and it just starts to really disappear and is pretty much gone by the time we get to the soul shrinks. And I was pondering that. Where does the alliteration go? It seems more than a coincidence at the beginning. It's so heavy, so forceful. But by the time the soul shrinks, it's mostly faded away, and we only get a few little moments that might be coincidence here and there. A little later in the poem, we get the, with a warm look, the world's reiteration of the W sound there. And then later on, a couple L's in a row, let lovers, let there be linen. So I wonder why that happens. What is it about the alliteration, the use of it at the beginning, but not at the end of this poem? Is it connected to the sleeping state for Wilbur? That alliterative is somehow like an earlier, a more primal state of versification. And so it's more connected to our sleeping, unconscious, drifting mind. And that when you awake, you're more determined, it's more calculated, it's more, finessed, Italianate even.
There's another kind of shift that happens after the third stanza. It's the first three stanzas are really just the description, the close description of describing the laundry out there blowing in the morning air. He hasn't even gotten out of bed yet. So this moment is sort of teased out into these three stanzas. So perhaps the alliteration is meant to, in some sense, sort of convey that blowing of the wind and the undulation of the laundry and the cranking of the pulley. I mean, there's all of those pieces of it that suggest that reiterative undulating quality that you get with the alliteration. And so then at that point, after the third stanza, it shifts into reflecting on broader significance of that thing just described. So it gets more reflective.
Yes.
At that point, which perhaps makes the language need to shift.
Yeah, the vision broadens and we're no longer meditating on the single image. Yes, I think I like that. That makes sense to me. The things you notice when you're a medievalist, all you look for is alliteration all the time. Where's the alliteration? It's here somewhere. It must be. Well, thank you ever so much for that very lovely poem. And we'll turn our attention to our next one. And this one was selected by, I think this is by Drew, right? The Baroque Wall Fountain?
Yes.
Okay. And I'll let you set it up and read it.
So this is an actual place, the Villa Chiara in Rome. And you can go and see this Baroque wall fountain. You can also see a really nice video of Richard Wilbur talking about living and working in Rome when the idea for this poem came to him, and listen to him read it. And he does a much better job of reading the poem than I can possibly do. He has a nice, deep, resonant voice. So you'll have to put up with my tinny, nasally voice for the time being. But go to YouTube and watch Richard Wilbur do this poem. A Baroque wall fountain in the Villa Chiara, under the bronze crown, too big for the head of the stone cherub whose feet a serpent has begun to eat. Sweet water brims a cockle and braids down past spattered mosses, breaks on the tipped edge of a second shell, and fills the massive third below. It spills in threads then from the scalloped rim and makes a scrim of a summery tent for a fawn menage and their familiar goose. Happy in all that ragged, loose collapse of water, its effortless descent and flatteries of spray, the stocky god upholds the shell with ease, watching about his shaggy knees the goatish innocence of his babes at play. His faunus all the while leans forward slightly into a clambering mesh of water lights, her sparkling flesh in a secular ecstasy, her blinded smile bent on the sand floor of the trefoil pool where ripple shadows come and go in swift reticulum, more addling to the eye than wine and more interminable to thought than pleasure's calculus. Yet since this all is pleasure, flash and waterfall, must it not be too simple? Are we not more intricately expressed in the plain fountain that Moderna set before St. Peter's, the main jet struggling aloft until it seems at rest in the act of rising, until the very wish of water is reversed, that heaviness is borne up to burst in a clear, high, cavorting head, to fill with blaze and then in gauze delays, in a gnat-like shimmering, in a fine, illumined version of itself, decline and patter on the stones its own applause. If that is what men are or should be, if those water saints display the pattern of our arete, what are these showered fauns in their bizarre, spangled, and plunging house? They are at rest in fullness of desire. For what is given, they do not tire of the smart of the sun, the pleasant water douse, and rippled pool below, reproving our disgust and our ennui with humble insatiety. Francis, perhaps, who lay in sister snow before the wealthy gate, freezing and praising, might have seen in this no trifle, but a shade of bliss, the land of tolerable flowers that state as near and far as grass, where eyes become the sunlight, and the hand is worthy of water, the dreamt land toward which all hungers leap, all pleasures pass.
Thank you for that, Drew. Can you explain to us what caught your eye about this poem?
It's funny you should put it caught your eye. It's what caught my ear about it probably first. The musicality of this is just utterly exquisite. But then there is something about it that catches your eye because it is a close description of a fountain, and you can envision it. And so when I looked up the images of this fountain, it looked almost precisely what I thought it would have looked like based on his description of it here, which is really remarkable to have achieved that. And just like in the other poem that we read, you can see how the description, the close attention to detail of one physical phenomenon then bends its way outward to draw in the cosmos, really. I mean, this poem, Wilbur said, is about desire and pleasure and about the sense that desire pushes us forward, seeking those things that the soul longs for. And you see that in the last line, the dreamt land toward which all hungers leap. But it hasn't strayed from the description of the fountain, because you can see the water spraying, leaping out from the fountain and being caught up into the fountain again and recirculated. So even in its speculations about the soul and its drives, it hasn't lost sight of the fountain, the physical thing that it is trying to describe and that inspired this beautiful song.
Other thoughts? Shall we look at the form? It's of a form A, B, B, A.
Yes, but it doesn't have any end-stopped lines, so you don't get the sense of the stanzas. The rhymes just seem to sort of crop up in places, even though they are at the end of the lines, because the lines are all in jammed. It's almost like a continuous flowing and recirculating of the water, just like the fountain, you know, with the water in a continuous stream. So I think the form just really beautifully captures exactly what it's trying to describe.
Very, very long sentences that last multiple stanzas. The final two stanzas and the line of the antepenultimate stanza, the last line of the antepenultimate stanza, are all one sentence, beginning with Francis, perhaps. So it's I think that this continuous stretching, linking together of the stanzas in long sentences is very fluid. It really does capture the essence of fluidity and a lack of separation. We don't imagine water. I mean, unless we're talking about ice cubes, we don't imagine water as being disparate, but rather all of a piece. And the poem delivers that with those enjambed lines and long sentences.
Mm-hmm. The serpent of the third line, I think, really also captures that quality of these long periodic sentences. There's a serpentine quality to these sentences. Mm-hmm.
I think it's also worth considering the fountain that Wilbur sets in contrast to the Baroque wall fountain. He says, yet since this all is pleasure, flash and waterfall, must it not be too simple? Are we not more intricately expressed in the plain fountains that Moderna set before St. Peter's, the main jet struggling aloft? Until it seems at rest in the act of rising, until the very wish of water is reversed, that heaviness born up to burst then a clear, high, cavorting head, to fill with blaze, and then a gauze, delays, and gnat-like shimmering, and a fine, illumined version of itself, decline, and patter on the stones its own applause. If that is what men are, or should be, if those water saints display the pattern of our arete, what of those showered fawns and their bizarre, spangled, and plunging house? And if you look look at that picture of the fountain that he suggests in front of St. Peter's Basilica, it is it's not so broke. It's symmetrical, and there's an even flow of the water. The water, you know, goes up and comes back down over over a dome, back into a bowl, and then, you know, over and over again. And I think the symmetry of the fountain, the regular pattern of the water, and then the presence of saints as opposed to the presence of, you know, I think that's an interesting one.
Yes, I think that's exactly right, Jack. And it's a reflection on the difference between a Baroque and a classical style piece of art. And Baroque, you know, is so exuberant and over the top. And the classical is deceptively simple because it's actually quite complex, but it looks very simple at first glance. And so it's interesting that he says, is the Baroque fountain not too simple as a description for us? And maybe the apparently simple classical fountain is actually closer to our complexity, which was a paradox, but I think an apt paradox. And the description of the way the water moves in that fountain in St. Peter's Square, where it forms a dome of water, I think is so perfectly done, because he says at one point, you don't know whether or not it's water returning in on itself. And that's exactly how it looks, because you can't tell whether the water's coming up or coming down. It just makes this perfect domed wall of water.
And he says it's contrary to the natural desires of water, right?
Yes, it looks like it's going up instead of falling down.
And I mean, and that's what sainthood is, right? It's the denial of our basest desires, and it's instead like the ascension of the soul. And I think that's as if with a pulley. That's right. And I think there's this little quote from Richard Wilbur. And I think this conversation that he's putting these two fountains in is a sort of debate that he has with himself that's prompted by the Baroque fountain. He says, this Baroque fountain appeared to me the very symbol or concretion of pleasure. I felt reproached by it for my puritanical industry, and at last I compromised with it by making it the subject of a poem. So there's the form of the fountain, the movement of the water, and the subjects, right? The fountain at St. Peter's is surrounded by saints. And then the Baroque fountain in the Via Sciarra is surrounded by, pagan minor deities. So there's that conversation about, you know, what's beautiful and what is,
But he felt as if the fountain was, he describes this in the video too, where you can watch him reading this and talking about it. He said that he saw this fountain every day as he was walking to work, and it almost felt as if the fountain with its unabashed enjoyment of itself was chiding him for his, industriousness, his punctuality and determination to just get the job done instead of, you know, stopping to smell the roses or look at the fountain. Which is just so perfect. I mean, the idea for this poem just came from that, and you can hear that, I think, in the poem.
Oh, certainly, right? They are at rest in the fullness of desire for what is given. They do not tire of the smart of the sun, right? They have everything they enjoy, and they do not tire of enjoyment. And I love these two lines: reproving our disgust and our ennui with humble insatiety. Humble insatiety.
Yes.
Which we would not normally think of insatiety as being humble. But here we have this, we do have humble insatiety, because they're not seeking, the desire is only for what is given, right? As we see at the beginning of that sentence, they're at rest in fullness of desire for what is given, not for what they do not have, but for what they receive. They want only more of what they receive, and they are at rest, not pursuit. They're at rest. So it's not gluttony or some disordered affection. It's a desire for more of that to which they are, you know, designed and entitled, in the same way that
it's like this circling of God's
attention and grace, right?
It's that circling of the blessed souls around God as light and life in Dante's Paradiso. It reminded me of something that Jasper Griffin used to make this joke often. He was an Oxford classicist, and he said that medieval depictions of hell had to be particularly ferocious and terrifying because you wanted people to be more afraid of hell than they were bored with the depictions of heaven. And it does touch on a serious point, which is that it's very difficult to describe overwhelming pleasure that doesn't wind up being saccharine or dull. And, you know, many great works of literature do a much better job of describing what's broken rather than describing what's beautiful. And so I think this is remarkable, just like in a greater way, Dante's Paradiso is, in making this so beautiful, in making a kind of heavenly vision actually seem feasible and not dull and not saccharine.
It's something I've found in a Disraeli comment that Disraeli on Working Days wrote that he liked to watch the sunlight on the bindings of the books. That's on Working Days. Mm. And I can very happily sit here in the library for hours on end and just watch the sunlight on the bindings of the books or trace across the keyboard of the piano. And that is not a seeking or an emptiness that needs to be filled up, but rather a taking delight in what is. And I think that is, if that's what eternity is, then I'm perfectly happy with that. Right? Peace, right? A sort of satisfied peace with what is. So let that reprove our disgust and our ennui with humble insatiety. We have two more poems. We'll move on to Mind next, which has been selected by Jack. And I'm pulling it up right now. This is a fairly short poem, comparatively. The other one's been quite long. It's only three stanzas. And then I think we'll have time for one more after this. So I'll turn this over to Jack.
Mind. Mind, in its purest play, is like some bat that beats about in caverns all alone, contriving by a kind of senseless wit not to conclude against a wall of stone. It has no need to falter or explore. Darkly it knows what obstacles are there, and so may weave and flitter and dip and soar in perfect courses through the blackest air. And has the simile a like perfection? The mind is like a bat? Precisely. Save that in the very happiest intellection, a graceful error may correct the cave.
That rhyme on intellection is very clever.
Perfection, intellection.
Indeed.
That's a good one. That's a good one. You have to go to Harvard to make those. So far be it from us. Yeah, I think this one, I think this one, you know, shows a little bit of the philosophical side to Richard Wilbur. You know, one might be struck by the similarities, you know, mind trapped in a cave, or the souls in Plato chained up in the cave where they see you know, a parade of shadows on the wall. Mm. Or if one is in more of a modern move, what mood might one might think of Nagel's bats, Nagel's famous argument against materialism, in which he says there is the quality of being a bat, which is immaterial, right? And it's his argument against it. And of course, that postdates the poem. The simile, you know, the mind is like a bat. It flits about in a dark cave. It runs up against limitations. We can't see these limitations, right? Because if we could speak of them clearly, they wouldn't be limitations per se. Right. The simile, of course, breaks down and that bats can leave caves. And I thought that was interesting, the picture of a bat leaving a cave. And And that question of, is it possible for our thoughts to, you know, sort of flitter out of the caves of their limitations, by some, a graceful error may correct the cave. Cause, before in the poem, it's the cave corrects the bat, right? It flits so far and, it bumps against the rocks of the cave in the darkness. But sometimes, error corrects the cave, you know, you go too far in one direction and then you find that the cave lets up.
Yes, this is a really rich poem. I mean, it almost makes one think that Richard Wilbur is among the metaphysical poets, you know, mm-hmm. with Donne and Herbert. This idea of the bat cavorting by a kind of senseless wit. To get it very philosophical, which I think this poem is trying to do, Plato had, of course, the idea that the soul knows things that it did not experience through its five senses, and that there's a knowledge that the soul operates under that cannot come from the senses because it doesn't line up with the world that we see. So, for instance, the idea of justice. We've never actually seen perfect justice. In fact, all the evidence about us is contrary to justice, and yet the soul knows the idea of justice and is convinced about it and operates as if it's true. Mm-hmm. And I think that's exactly described here, that this bat flying about in the dark, contriving by a kind of senseless wit not to conclude against a wall of stone. It's not being led by what it can see. It sort of has an awareness of the cave that's extrasensory.
Mm-hmm.
Darkly, it knows what obstacles are there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I also like its self-reflective quality. The last stanza is reflecting on the analogy that's just been depicted. It says, and has this simile a like perfection? The mind is like a bat, precisely. Save that in the very happiest of intellection, a graceful error may correct the cave. So mm-hmm. it reflects on itself, and it says the analogy works, except in this one way. Right. And I'm not sure I fully appreciate what it is. A graceful error may correct the cave.
Hmm.
It can't just be running into the walls of the cave.
Right.
But that the cave itself gets reshaped
yes.
by some sort of mistake.
Right. I mean, you know, the cave, how do the bats get in the cave in the first place? I mean, it's got to have some sort of opening. Eventually, in the darkness, they may find their way out. It makes me think of going to Carlsbad Caverns in southern New Mexico, and it's a national park. You wait and wait and wait, and then around twilight, a million bats leave this hole in the ground. It's really the sound it's indescribable, of a million winged mammals exiting the earth. Yes, the cave can be corrected because the cave has an opening. The simile itself has an opening, right? There's a sort of a chink in the armor, an opening in the cave. And, our thoughts themselves have openings.
Yes. I also think that there's, a graceful error could be not a bad English translation of felix culpa. The fortunate mistake. Which is what leads to, the incarnation of God. Mm-hmm. I think that's sort of exactly what he has in mind here.
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. No, because it's in this, this is like, for me, I'm glad you brought up Thomas Nagel's What's It Like to Be a Bat? Because it's a really good point, right? That this is, for me, a poem about what we would call the philosophy of perception, right? The way that we perceive the world. And the mind, right, it experiences perception in this very kind of darksome way, right? It darkly, it knows what obstacles there are through perception, right? It has sonar and it can flit about and it can feel the air moving in the cave and it can get some sense of the shape of the cave. And so in the concluding stanza, we have this assertion that the simile is precisely like a bat. The mind is precisely like a bat, except that in the very happiest of intellection, a graceful error may correct the cave. And that would to say when what we're trying to avoid, right, is to conclude against a wall of stone, when that might happen, when the mind's perception may run up against a fault that causes it to crash into the wall of the cave, graceful error may change the shape of the cave and save mankind, save the mind from that collision. That would be to change the nature of reality itself. And what graceful error can actually change the nature of reality, not merely our perception of it, but the reality that exists beyond the perception, right? And I think the only thing I can think of, and that seems to make sense here, is the incarnation, right, which changes reality.
Well, or the resurrection,
yeah,
right?
The resurrection. The
resurrection changes the nature of reality. You come back from death.
Yeah, exactly. Right. That's it, exactly, right? From that point on, we don't have that collision with that part of the wall anymore, right? Mm-hmm. Our sin no longer causes us to collide irrevocably with the wall of eternal death. Instead, this happy fault provides the opportunity for the cave to be corrected so that we can miss that pitfall. We can miss that wall, as it were.
Mm-hmm. It even plays with our, you know, very modern image of what a devil looks like, you know, because we think of the devil as bat-like and with bat-like wings. And so this image of the soul as basically a little devil, you know, the fallen soul, the corrupted soul, that then it's to escape through a gracious error.
Well, thank you for that poem, Jack. We have
thank Richard Wilbur, not me.
Well, you selected it, and he's not here. So we have to thank you. We have time for one more, and I've selected this one, but I'm not going to read it. Instead, I'm going to throw it to Drew, and it's called Year's End, and it's not Year's End yet, but I've been thinking of it because, of course, this is the week of Thanksgiving if you live in the United States, and for many people, this begins sort of the steady consumerist march towards the extravaganza that is New Year's, right? Which to some degree kind of encloses and even overshadows sometimes Christmas, kind of hunkered down in the middle of this procession. But for us, Thanksgiving is the time when we kind of welcome in that winter season, even though, of course, winter won't begin until the 21st of January or 21st of December. So that's when we after Thanksgiving, we put up the Christmas tree and we turn our thoughts to the end of the year.
Well, it's a bit early, don't you think?
Well, I suppose it is, but we have a family tradition of doing this because we don't do the Black Friday consumerist extravaganza. I don't go in for that. And so something we can do instead as a family is we erect the tree. We don't put the decorations on, but we erect the tree, which requires a moving of furniture and a rearrangement of the lounge where the tree goes, because we've given it a very prominent place in our house, in the very front room of the house. And that means moving the furniture. And so that is what we do. And then we put up the rest of the decorations in the house, which means taking down all the Thanksgiving things and putting up all the, you know, the little doodads and wreaths and what on the door. And then the lights and stuff go up on the tree in Advent. But that's our day that we begin, right, is for us the day after Thanksgiving. And so I thought this would be a great poem.
The procession has begun.
Yeah, it's the assembly of all the participants. We haven't quite started, but we're mustering. It's the mustering towards winter. And I think always for me after that point, I'm a little bit more accepting of cold weather too, which I loathe and detest. And I'm very intolerant of it before Thanksgiving. But afterwards, I said, well, you know, it's after Thanksgiving. You have to accept a little snow. So here we are. We'll go to winter with Richard Wilbur.
Now winter downs the dying of the year, and night is all a settlement of snow. From the soft street, the rooms of houses show a gathered light, a shapen atmosphere, like frozen over lakes whose ice is thin and still allows some stirring down within. I've known the wind by water banks to shake the late leaves down, which frozen where they fell and held in ice as dancers in a spell, fluttered all winter long into a lake. Graved on the dark in gestures of descent, they seemed their own most perfect monument. There was perfection in the death of ferns, which laid their fragile cheeks against the stone a million years. Great mammoths, overgrown, composedly have made their long sojourns, like palaces of patience in the gray and changeless land of ice. And at Pompeii, the little dog lay curled and did not rise, but slept the deeper as the ashes rose and found the people incomplete, and froze the random hands, the loose, unready eyes of men expecting yet another sun to do the shapely thing they had not done. These sudden ends of time must give us pause. We fray into the future, rarely wrought save in the tapestries of afterthought. More time, more time. Barrages of applause come muffled from a buried radio. The New Year bells are wrangling with the snow.
Thank you for that, Drew. Well, here we have, I hope it's not too grim, but there's a sort of memento mori aspect to it, right?
Indeed.
A reminder that time is brief and man knows not his hour. And I also like this connection here between not only the lake with the frozen leaves, but the great eons of time in which, like, a mammoth has been frozen in some, you know, faraway tundra in Norway or Denmark or something and discovered only lately. And then also connected to something not cold at all, a different kind of burial and being frozen in time, that of Pompeii, where the pyroclastic flows buried the people and the animals and froze them in their moment of agony. And all these things that we have are frozen moments, as it were, right? The people, the places, the things are encapsulated for us so that we can access them again in the future. That moment can be carried forward. That's the...
Well, this is, I think, what makes New Year's such a haunting occasion, yes, because it's about death, the death of a year, and also birth, the birth of a new year. And it almost forces us to reflect on what we've left undone, and also to think about what we resolve to do in the time that we hope will be given to us in the next year. We hope the sun's going to rise the next day. We shouldn't take it for granted that it will.
These sudden ends of time, right? The year, despite the fact that we look at it 12 months, but the end of the year is a very sudden thing, really.
Uh-huh.
1 minute it's 2021 and the next it's 2022. All of a sudden. It happens in the blink of an eye, and the year is over. And I love that in this sudden end, this instant, though Wilbur says it must give us pause. It's a wonderful allusion, right, to Hamlet, who's also pondering what lies beyond. And he says that these dreams, right, that what dreams may come must give us pause. That dream of death he's talking about. So here Hamlet and Richard Wilbur say, you know, we must pause to ponder our end, ponder the final things, because we fray into the future rarely wrought. Rarely wrought. We leave it unmade so often, right?
Yes. The form of this poem also, I think, is aptly suited to the point that it tries to convey. You know, the first two poems that we read were heavily enjammed and sentences that spread across stanzas. And very often it did not emphasize the end of a stanza. So you wouldn't hear it unless you saw it on the page where a stanza ended. But here you can hear the end of every stanza very plainly. And every stanza ends with a period except for one.
The central stanza.
The central one, yeah. So it has that sense of closure with every stanza in a way that the other poems did not. You can see this fitting of form to the meaning, or the fitting of sound to sense, as Pope put it.
Well, thank you for reading that for me, Drew. I appreciate it. And with that,
it was a pleasure.
We've come to the end of another episode. Now, next week, I'm tempted to say by popular demand, because it is actually somewhat by request or by reminder. Next week, we'll be looking at the poetry of Ted Hughes. And this is sort of a follow-up to our podcast on Sylvia Plath a few weeks ago. We had a reader who said, you know, very nice, excellent. Now you must do Ted Hughes. And I had thought when we recorded Sylvia Plath that we had already done so. And then I realized afterwards that we hadn't. So we will rectify that. We will do Ted Hughes. And both to help our listeners and to help me, as we've now exceeded 100 podcasts and it's hard to keep them all kind of in order in my mind. I have added to the Critical Readings website a helpful authorial index. So if you go to criticalreadings.com and you go to the podcast menu, the very first link in the menu is Index by Author. And when you click that, it will take you to an alphabetical page where it has all of our authors by their surnames. And if you click them, then you'll see all of the podcasts that include poems by that author. Now, sometimes that's only a single podcast. So if you click Robert Browning, you'll just see the 96th episode on his dramatic verse. But if you were to click, say, Samuel Taylor Coleridge, you'll find that we've had apparently 7 podcasts about Samuel Taylor Coleridge, including 2 on Christabel, 2 on The Rime of the Ancient Mariner, 2 on Lyrical Ballads, and 1 on his dream poems. Coleridge gets quite a bit of love around here. And you'll notice
it was all before our time.
Yeah. Yes, before our time.
Well, that was with Clinton and I, because, of course, Clinton and I did an MA course on the Romantic Book of Poetry, which focused on lyrical ballads and Innocence and Experience by Blake. So we covered those pretty thoroughly. But there are this alphabetical list has called to my attention as I was making it many things that I thought were on the list that I thought we had covered, which we had not. Not just Ted Hughes, but some very important authors indeed. And so you can look forward to some very critical readings forthcoming in the near future. And every time we upload a new episode, it will be included in that list, so it will be continually updated. So if you're teaching a class, or you're studying a particular piece of poetry or a particular author, maybe you're working on a paper, or maybe you're just reading for your own pleasure, this is a good way to go and see if we've covered it, and then we can be there as a sort of, you know, co-reader with you, as it were. You can listen to us, and you can do your reading, and hopefully we'll help you along and give you some things to think about.
And if we show up in a paper, we want due citations.
That's correct.
You can actually cite critical readings. It is citable. And there are MLA and Chicago and APA guidelines for citing websites and podcasts. So do feel free to cite us. I would love to see critical readings turn up in a citation. It would say something like Cooper, comma, Sean Phillip, comma, Drew Keene, comma, and Jack Tyler, comma, Eds, full stop. Critical readings, or it would have the episode in quotes, and then it would say critical readings 103, and then it would have a date and a URL. So there you go. Well, I hope to be better next week for excuse me, for our episode on Ted Hughes, and extra thanks this week to Drew Keene and Jack Tyler for taking up the slack. And I'm sorry that I've not had much to say, but hopefully next week I'll be fit and ready to pontificate at length. Many thanks, gentlemen. Thank you to Jack Tyler.
Well, thank you for having me once again.
And thank you to Drew Keene.
It's been a great pleasure.
And thank you especially to our listeners and our donators. And a thank you this week to Turnus, who increased his patronage. We noticed that, and we wanted to make sure we called attention to it. So thank you ever so much. If you'd like to help support Critical Readings, you can do so by going to criticalreadings.com and clicking Become a Patron. And that will take you to a page on Patreon where you can subscribe for as little as $5 a month or more. And this helps to offset our hosting costs, which run to about $350-ish dollars a year. If you don't have the money, don't worry. We will never gate any part of the podcast behind a paywall. It'll always be available for everyone free of charge. That way, those who have a little extra can help to support it for those who do not. Thank you to everyone, listeners and patrons alike. That's it from us. We'll be back next week with an episode on Ted Hughes. Until then, from all of us here at Critical Readings, Godspeed. You've been listening to Critical Readings, with special thanks to our supporters, Turnus, Alessandro, and Lisa. Copyright Sean Phillip Cooper. All rights reserved.